Anastasia Bowden, and I'm the director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies here at the Cato Institute. In January of 1872, a group of butchers came to the Supreme Court seeking to enforce the newly enacted 14th Amendment and to reclaim their right to earn a living from the clutches of an unholy alliance between private interests and overeager government. The butchers argued that the state of Louisiana had granted favored interest groups a monopoly over butcher services, taking away their ability to put food on the table, and that under the 14th Amendment, they had a right to compete. Now, historians can argue about whether a monopoly was truly needed to remedy any sanitary issues of the time. But for the Supreme Court, whether the law was a legitimate law or simple economic protectionism did not matter. As the court has done so many times since, it effectively nullified a key part of that vastly important Civil Rights Amendment and ruled that the Privileges or Immunities Clause only protects a very narrow set of rights, which does not include the right to earn a living. It therefore left the precious right to channel one's passions and energies, to earn, to thrive, to make the world better, to provide for oneself and one's family, to find work in the occupation of one's choice, without any meaningful judicial protection and subject to the whims of legislative majorities. The court basically deemed the dispute none of their business. Not much has changed in the 150 years since. Just last year, a woman from Louisiana who sought to provide care for special needs kids went to the Supreme Court asking the justices to protect her right to enter her dream profession. There was no question she was qualified, but Louisiana had denied her the ability to even seek licensure as a caregiver on the theory that there were already enough caregivers around and it didn't want to spend any time or money licensing anybody new. Because of the slaughterhouse cases and the court's continued unwillingness to protect economic liberty under the 14th Amendment, she was deprived of her dream, and Louisiana special needs children and their families were deprived of an important resource. The effect of the Supreme Court's refusal to enforce the 14th Amendment has been devastating. It's left a hole in civil rights law because equality means nothing without the right to lift oneself up by the bootstraps and to leave the circumstances of your birth. This legacy has left entrepreneurs of all kinds without any judicial recourse when the legislature keeps them out of a job. Physicians trying to work from home, hair braiders, taxi drivers, florists, household movers. Many of these people have been left destitute and their potential clients without options and with higher priced services, all because the courts offer no protection to the right to earn a living. And though the courts keep telling us this is a policy dispute, we know there's no effective recourse in the legislature. We know that political minorities of all kinds, whether religious, racial, or ideological minorities, and of course the smallest minority is the individual, they can't adequately protect themselves from the majority, and that's exactly why we have a constitution and judicial review. There can be no individual rights without effective judicial review. And as the court has shied away from scrutinizing laws that restrict economic opportunity, licensing laws and other laws that restrict people from getting a job or from keeping the fruits of their labor have metastasized. But maybe, just maybe, it's not all the court's fault. Maybe it's time for a moment of introspection. At least that's the premise of this event. The vast majority of litigation aiming to restore the right to earn a living has been rooted in the 14th Amendment, with litigators hoping that with better facts, more sympathetic plaintiffs, even more arbitrary laws, and even better lawyering, they can convince the court to take economic liberty seriously. But perhaps it's time to go beyond the 14th Amendment. What can we, as lawyers, as researchers, academics, policy wonks, pundits, or people who simply care about entrepreneurship and innovation, do to restore the right to earn a living once we look to other parts of the Constitution? Cato Center for Constitutional Studies solicited papers about going beyond the 14th Amendment and looking for underexplored ways of restoring economic liberty, and today we'll discuss the content of those papers, which will be published in a special journal edition later this summer. We hope that litigators will take those papers to heart and use them as a blueprint to make real change. Our first panel will feature two litigators and their experiences suing in state courts and the myriad unexplored opportunities for protecting economic liberty through state constitutions. Our second panel, moderated by another economic liberty warrior, my colleague Clark Neely, will discuss the threat presented by licensing bodies and ways of fighting against cronyism via state and federal law and the U.S. Constitution. And last, Dr. Prashant Narang will discuss 100 years of economic liberty litigation in India to find surprising parallels and insights for restoring the right to earn a living here in the United States. We'll have breaks for coffee and snacks in between and lunch right after. But for now, I'd like to bring up our first two panelists, Timothy Sandifer and Anthony Sanders. Please give them a warm welcome. I think you're just that way. Okay, to my left, we have Timothy Sandifer. Tim is the Vice President for Legal Affairs at the Goldwater Institute's Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation, and he holds the Duncan Chair in Constitutional Government. He is the author of 8 books, including most relevant here, The Right to Earn a Living. I think it's outside if anyone wants to take one home. It's right here. Yeah. And also more than 50 scholarly articles on subjects ranging from Indian law and antitrust to copyright law to the constitutional issues involved in the Civil War and the political philosophy of Shakespeare, ancient Greek drama, and Star Trek. He's an adjunct scholar with the Cato Institute, and we're happy to have him here to speak with us today. To my far left, we have Anthony Sanders. He's the director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice and a senior attorney there. Anthony has litigated several cases concerning state constitutional protections in various state courts, as well in federal courts on matters such as economic liberty, free speech, administrative laws, and fees and fines abuse. He's the author of the book, again, available here today and right there, Baby Ninth Amendments, How Americans Embraced Unenumerated Rights and Why It Matters. So to start, Tim, I wanted to let you have the floor to discuss the paper you submitted to the symposium and what we can do to bring back economic liberty at the state level.
Thank you. So my paper is a practitioner's guide to doing state constitutional litigation in defense of economic liberty and private property rights. And I offer some ideas on how to do this because this has not been well explored by litigators so far. Although we all know that state constitutions provide protections for individual rights that the federal constitution does not, or that state courts have interpreted their constitutions in ways that are more protective than federal courts have done. This has been a largely unexplored territory, even though those of us who are in this profession have been trying to persuade lawyers to take advantage of this opportunity for several years. So, for example, state constitutions include provisions such as the Fruits of Their Labor Clause, which, by the way, was the subject of a decision from the North Carolina courts just this week, saying that unjustifiable restrictions on economic freedom deprive people of the fruits of their labor. The Fruits of Their Labor Clause is largely a legacy of the Civil War, when state constitutions were either rewritten or amended to protect people's right to economic freedom. State constitutions also include provisions such as the Gift Clause, which is a provision in almost every state constitution that forbids the government from subsidizing private businesses with taxpayer dollars. Different states have different language. Arizona, where I live, has the strongest of the gift clauses in the country that prohibits any form of subsidy to private business by the government of any sort. But these provisions exist in every state constitution to level the playing field and to prevent the government from forcing people to subsidize their own competition. The state constitutions include special law clauses. These are provisions that forbid the government from targeting its legislation to specific individuals or small groups. Instead, a law has to be general. That's the whole point of a law. A law is a general rule that applies to everybody. So a special law clause prohibits the legislature from targeting specifically and giving benefits or imposing burdens on particular people. So I talk about these provisions and the challenges that we face. One of the challenges we face is because these clauses have been so overlooked by the legal profession over the years, there's not a lot of scholarship that's been done about them. So there's a lot of these clauses, the history behind them has been largely ignored. And this is really, if you think about it, it's kind of shocking. Now, the reasons why is because, you know, law professors, you're not going to become a superstar law professor if you become the world's leading expert on the Access to the Beaches Clause of the California Constitution. You know, Law professors want to be able to move from state to state to get a more prestigious academic appointment during their career. And one way to do that is become the world's leading expert on some federal provision. But if you start tinkering in state constitutional law, it's an academic dead end for a lot of professors. Judges, then, they don't see these arguments being made by the law, legal profession, because the lawyers, you know, they go to law school. The law schools are being taught by these professors. They learn primarily federal law. State constitutional law is, you know, an elective course, if anything, in a state, in your law school. Most law students never take it. So they show up in court unprepared to make these kinds of arguments. They don't know anything about the background. And of course, these lawyers then go on to become judges, and they haven't learned anything more about their state constitution in the interim. And then there are political problems where judges are timid about sticking their necks out and being the first to impose a stronger protection at the state constitutional level than is already provided by the feds. If you're a state judge and you say, well, here's the law in the federal courts, so we're just going to follow that, that's politically safe. Whereas if you're a state judge and you say, you know what, we think the federal law is wrong, we're going to be more protective, we're going to say, you know, you have stronger rights, we're going to prohibit the police searches without a warrant, et cetera. If you do that, then that is not politically feasible for if you're facing a retention election. So there are lots of challenges, but there are also lots of opportunities. Almost, I mean, it's amazing how many state constitutions were rewritten between 1865 and 1900. There was a constitutional revolution in this country during that period. Most states held a convention, wrote a brand new constitution, rewrote their constitution or something like that during that period. And that's the equivalent of a brand new federal constitution in some ways, right? And yet we overlook the enormous transformation. And during that transformation, the lessons that had been learned in the interim that state constitution makers then implemented in order to protect people more than the federal constitution has done. So my article offers some tips on how to make these arguments, and I very much hope to see lawyers take that path.
Anthony, your paper also discusses litigation at the state level with a particular emphasis, I think, as is natural, on baby Ninth Amendments. So tell us the premise of your article.
Sure. So first, thank you for inviting me to speak here today, and it's an honor to be a part of this conversation. I think there's a lot of hope for economic liberty and the right to earn a living, both in state constitutions and under the 14th Amendment in federal court. And I know we'll get to that later, but I see signs both in lower federal courts and in state courts of all levels more and more recently. So despite what you may hear going on at 1 First Street, I think there's a lot of green shoots in this area. So I talk about one particular part of that landscape, and that's these things that I call baby Ninth Amendments. I didn't make up the term, but I like it. I like babies, so let's call them baby Ninth Amendments. So these provisions are in 2/3 of all state constitutions. They're one of these provisions that Tim talks about in his excellent paper. And they are, as you might imagine, essentially the language of the Ninth Amendment in the U.S. Constitution in state constitutions. The enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Key language from the Ninth Amendment. So what do these mean? Well, as you might know, there's this huge battle, there has been for a long time in the scholarship, about what the Ninth Amendment means. Does it mean what it says, as Randy Barnett says? Or is it actually more about federalism, or it's just about was reminding the framers at the time of the adoption of the, just after the adoption of the Constitution, that we shouldn't expand enumerated powers? And in any case, the Supreme Court has never really touched the Ninth Amendment, only said a few things about it, basically in passing over the years. And so this debate has raged. Do they actually protect unenumerated rights? And what are those unenumerated rights? So in my book, I turn to these baby Ninth Amendments that few people have talked about over the years, but not that many. Now, it turns out in the states, they take these a little bit more seriously than the U.S. Supreme Court has taken the Ninth Amendment. And sometimes they do treat them to mean what they say, to protect unenumerated rights. And the takeaway that I give after diving in and looking at how different states have dealt with these and how some state courts have actually taken them seriously, including protecting the right to earn a living, is that when you pull back from this, you see that lots and lots of state constitutions explicitly protect unenumerated rights in a way that I think the argument is even stronger than it is for the Ninth Amendment, although I think the arguments are strong for the Ninth Amendment and the 14th Amendment too. So what does that mean? That means that Americans, over the course of U.S. history, from the early days of the 19th century through the last one of these was readopted in Rhode Island in the 80s, over the course of U.S. history, Americans have wanted to protect unenumerated rights. So they enumerate a provision that refers to unenumerated rights. This is something that, you know, a lot of judges of various persuasions are horrified by. Well, why would you put that in the Constitution? It just allows judges to do whatever they want. Well, it doesn't. It actually has words in there you can interpret. And more importantly, this is kind of a aspect of American constitutionalism that's baked in to allow judges to protect rights beyond just those that are enumerated, because you can't enumerate everything. And I think most people get that, and that's why we have that in our Constitution. So on the actual article I've written for this conference, I take what I talk about in the book and I expand on some stories of how these baby Ninth Amendments have protected the right to earn a living in state courts, stories that I wish I had included in the book, and I expand on from the book. So I won't talk about all of them here, but there's a few cases I go into detail about how this was an instance where there was a barrier on an entrepreneur earning a living. The entrepreneur was in court, invoked this provision in the state baby Ninth Amendment to protect his or her right to earn a living, and the court protected it. And you know what? Everything was fine. We didn't have a loss of health and safety and an ill ability of the government to keep order after that. We didn't have the anarchy that you sometimes hear about. What will happen if judges just start protecting the right to earn a living with unenumerated rights? And these people were protected, and everything was okay. Just to give one example of that, because I think it ties in with the current mood of the country, there was a case in Oregon in the 1930s where a local parish, Catholic parish, wanted to attach a school, day school, to its church. And what was the problem with that? Zoning laws. Zoning said you couldn't have a school, just a little school for children, of the neighborhood, in this neighborhood, and you had the usual, what we today call NIMBYs, objecting to having this school, and the case went to the Oregon Supreme Court, and it was on the back of a lot of anti-Catholic animus that had been going on in Oregon at that time. If some of you know the story of how the KKK. Helped enact a law by the initiative in the 1920s to ban private schooling. That had been struck down by the Supreme Court at that point, but this was still in the air. And so the Oregon Supreme Court could have said this was a religious liberty thing, that they couldn't open the school, but they said this was about the right to run a school, which is a vocation, of course. And even though there was this zoning law that said that they couldn't open this this business attached to their church, the court said that, you know, your arguments don't make sense. You're saying that the screams of the children will annoy the neighbors, even though the traffic that's already there is louder than the children, and none of this makes sense. And so, therefore, it's an arbitrary law, and the church can open a school. And I think lesson from that and other cases that I talk about in the paper can hopefully inspire both litigators who can take Tim's paper and get a blueprint for how to litigate these cases, and also inspire judges that you can do the right thing and everything's going to be okay.
Thanks for that. Well, by now, you've both heard each other speak, and I hope looked at each other's papers, so I'd love to offer you some time to comment on anything the other has said.
Well, not just the paper, but Anthony's book, which is very important. I think it's very frustrating. The term unenumerated rights always sets my teeth on edge, because there's no such thing as unenumerated rights, because the Constitution protects liberty. And the word liberty just means a literally infinite list of individual rights. The term unenumerated rights is a loaded term. It's an attempt to frame the question in order to ignore what the Ninth Amendment says. It's an attempt to frame the question in order to exclude or denigrate rights that are not specified by name in the Constitution. But think of all the things in the federal Constitution or state. Think of the things that aren't specified in the state or federal constitutions. The federal Constitution does not require Congress to publish its laws, for example. Not explicitly. And yet I think we would all regard it as horrendously unconstitutional if Congress were to pass a law in secret and then enforce it by arresting people for violating it, right? That'd be blatantly unconstitutional, be a violation of the Due Process Clause, among other things. Yet the Constitution doesn't explicitly require Congress to publish its laws. So the point is that there are implicit principles in both the state and federal constitutions that protect individual rights. And the Ninth Amendment and the baby Ninth Amendments do just that. That's the role of them. You can't list all human rights, because if you tried to do that, you would say, you know, a person has the right to wake up late on a Tuesday, and a right to wake up early on a Tuesday, and a right to wake up on time on a Tuesday, and also the same rights when it comes to Wednesdays. And the list would just go on and on. So the reason why Americans, as you put it in the book, the reason Americans love unenumerated rights provisions is because they recognize that. They know that. It takes years of law school at America's greatest institutions of higher learning to forget about that and to misread the Constitution as profoundly as our legal system has done in so many respects. So I think what Anthony's offering in the history, delving into the history of these clauses and to these, I was going to say obscure cases, but that's unfair. It's not that they're obscure. It's that they've been ignored by law professors and legal academics and legal scholars for such a long time. So I think the book, the reason I like it so much is it offers so much hope for us as lawyers and as judges. Because I think when I spoke earlier, I was perhaps overly pessimistic about state judges being willing to stick their necks out. The reality is, as Anthony said, that a lot of times judges are willing to come out and say, you know, our Constitution says something different. The Texas Supreme Court in the Patel case is probably the most prominent example of that, and said, you know, the federal standard doesn't work for us. We need more protection in Texas. And then Justice Willett wrote this marvelous concurring opinion that explores the history and why the federal rules aren't good enough and we need more protection in Texas. That's fantastic. I think one reason state judges can be that way is because they feel more democratic because they are subject to elections. And so the federal court's reticence to protect these rights is based in this fear of being seen as anti-democratic, which I think is unwarranted, but I understand that it's there. And state judges don't have that. So there's, in that sense, there should be more room and for state judges to be willing to enforce so-called unenumerated rights.
Anthony?
Yes. So really what I have to say about Tim's paper is, if you're going to litigate in state court, you should read Tim's paper. Whether you're here with us today, you're watching this video 5 years from now, go find Tim's paper and read it before you go litigate this stuff in state court. Because it's something that there's been few of us who've been writing in this area for a long time, you know, baby Ninth Amendments, due process clauses, whatever. Tim puts it all together in one place. It's a one-stop shop that actually has been sorely needed. And it's great that it's going to be out there now. I think that the bigger question for me always that I thought about is, you know, why is it so sorely needed? Because everyone should know their state has a constitution. I mean, everyone does. So if you're going to go litigate for a client and you want to make these arguments that the government has been too intrusive, why has it taken so long to take state constitutions more seriously, not just some throwaway line at the end of your complaint or end of your appellate brief, but more seriously? And I think it's a lot of the reasons that Tim gives about the political economy, about law schools, how people are taught, what practitioners have time to do, what's off the shelf and what's not. There's also, as Tim talks about in the paper, there just are, unfortunately, harder aspects to litigating state constitutional law. So the payoff can be better for your client. You can have a higher standard of protection, whatever right you're talking about, right to earn a living, searches and seizures, what have you. But you may be in a state like Georgia that's had 10 constitutions, or 11, they count it different ways. Are you going to go look, read through the debates of each of those? You probably don't have time to do that when you're working on a deadline or you're trying to get a client out of jail or whatever it may be. So that falls to the rest of us to try to do some of that work and have it done. So it's not just when you have 30 days after your appeal is granted at the state Supreme Court to try and get that into a brief, whether you're a party or you're an amicus. So when in the future, when you're doing this, you should first go to Tim's paper, and then you should go to see if people have written about it. But the good thing is, this is changing. And now state it's a little bit of a state constitutionalist. It's a little bit of a cliche that state constitutions are the big thing because they've been the next big thing for like 50 years now. But over that 50 years, that started as kind of more of a progressive movement thing, and it has become more and more across the spectrum that people take state constitutions seriously. Judge Sutton's work of the last few years has been very helpful in this regard, whether you agree with him on certain aspects of state constitutionalism or not, to really bring this to the forefront. So there are a lot more tools to use when you're litigating state constitutions or just researching state constitutions than we had even 10 years ago. And we can talk about, you know, what some of those tools are, but I would encourage everyone to check those out.
Oh, all nice things you guys had to say about each other. No fighting words.
That's for you.
With my red pen when I review your articles later. In order to make change, I think we have to understand the problem. Why have courts, especially federal courts, been so reluctant to protect economic liberty? So, Tim, maybe you could tell us about rational basis review, what it is, and what you think. You alluded to one reason, maybe because these federal judges view themselves as not having a democratic quality to them. But why do you think they are reluctant to protect this very important right?
Well, the easiest answer is that it's just easy to stick with old habits, and the old habit is rational basis scrutiny, and it's just easy to get it off your desk that way. And unfortunately, there are many people who that's their motivating concern. But the perhaps the fairer answer would be rational basis scrutiny is the legal test courts use to determine whether a restriction on economic freedom or private property rights or et cetera, is constitutional or not. And it was invented by federal courts in the Nebbia versus New York case in 1934 when interpreting the 14th Amendment's due process clause. It said when the state wants to regulate the economy in a way that deprives people of economic freedom, in that case it was a minimum price on milk. This is how insane it was. This was during the Great Depression. New York passed a law prohibiting low prices for milk, literally making it more difficult for mothers to buy milk for their babies in the Great Depression. And the constitutionality of that was challenged in front of the Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, meh, it's fine with us, rational basis scrutiny. And state judges then just, a lot of them, just copied that, like, without even thinking about the fact that this is a federal principle. Assuming it's valid, there's no reason to apply it in the state context. And a lot of states have done this. There's a decision in a case called State versus Lupo from Alabama just a few years ago, where one of the justices wrote a separate opinion. He pointed out, you know, our Constitution was written before the Nebbia decision at a time when federal courts took economic liberty seriously. So there's no historical or theoretical justification for us to be following the Nebbia rule of rational basis in this context, which is a federal case that postdates our state constitution. So there's no originalism, there's no textualism, there's no history. It's just pure policy on the part of the state judges to say, yeah, well, we like the federal, we're just going to follow that. And unfortunately, that does happen a lot. A while back, the Arizona Supreme Court decided a case called State versus Mixton, which involves the Arizona Constitution's private affairs clause. This is a unique clause that only Arizona and Washington have that prohibits the government from intruding on a person's private affairs except by lawful authority. Very different from the Fourth Amendment in the federal Constitution. Fourth Amendment says no unreasonable searches. Our Constitution doesn't use the word reasonable. In other words, even a reasonable search is unconstitutional in Arizona if it's not done by lawful authority, which is not the rule in federal court. Nevertheless, when this question came to the Arizona Supreme Court, the Arizona Supreme Court said, we like the federal rule, we're just going to follow the federal rule. When there's no foundation for that whatsoever in the text, the history, no matter what your constitutional approach is, there's no justification for that. It's pure policymaking. If you're concerned about judicial restraint and judicial activism, that is pure judicial activism for the state court to say, we like the federal rule, it's just easier to apply, it results in things that we like better, so we're just going to follow that, regardless of the fact that the state constitution was purposely written to not have the language of the federal constitution in that respect. When it comes to economic liberty, a lot of the time the situation is even weirder in that we're talking about clauses in state constitutions that are older than the federal constitution, like Pennsylvania. You know, the Pennsylvania constitution's protections for individual liberty are older than the federal constitution. There's no justification for Pennsylvania judges to be copying lockstep, as we call it, to just follow in lockstep with the federal court's interpretation of the federal constitution's due process or privileges or immunities or equal protection clauses, when the Pennsylvania constitution is older. And if you're an originalist, then the federal courts should be following the states, not the other way around. And this is not just true of due process or privileges or immunities, this is true about regulatory matters also. This the big case pending right now in the U.S. Supreme Court, the Loper-Bright case about the power of the administrative state. You know, a lot of states have, in just the past few years, abandoned their version of so-called Chevron deference to administrative agencies. They've done so because they don't like the way it's working in the federal courts. There's no foundation for it in the state constitution. There's no reason for us to be doing what the feds do just because the feds do it. And in fact, we filed a brief in the Loper-Bright case pointing this out and saying, and as you said, all hell has not broken loose in the states. We don't have dogs and cats living together mass hysteria as a result of state courts going their own way and actually judging. Because that's what it comes down to, right? The rational basis test is just not judging. If you're a parent and you've ever been driving down the street and your kids are in the back and they're arguing and you can't stand it, and finally you say, I don't care who started it, just shut up. That's the rational basis test. That's the test that federal courts use when it comes to economic liberty and private property rights, particularly private property rights, which is referred to explicitly, not unenumerated. It is in the right to private property is enumerated in the federal constitution more than any other right. And yet it is relegated to this second class status of rational basis. Anything goes, government can get away with anything it wants to. That is truly irrational. Whereas state constitutions give us an opportunity to say, no, that's not the way things should be here. My favorite example of that being in Alaska, where in the 1970s, the Alaska Supreme Court said the state constitution protects the right to use marijuana in your own home as long as you're not committing crimes, harming other people, you know, hurting minors, whatever it might be. That obviously that can be outlawed, but you have a state constitutional right to consume marijuana in your own home because we in Alaska take privacy very seriously. It's in nobody else's business if you do. That kind of, if we talk about liking diversity, that's the kind of diversity, laboratories of the states, as we like to say, that's the kind of thing that federalism is supposed to protect. Anyway, long rambling answer to your question.
Anthony, you wrote in your paper, why don't courts protect economic liberty? Is it a love of central economic planning, an extreme reluctance to second-guess legislatures, the haunting of Lochner's ghost? Is economic liberty simply an innocent bystander knocked down like Mrs. Palsgraf in a conservative stampede away from the right to privacy? Like many things in life and law, there is no one correct monocausal answer. I wonder if you have any additional reasons in addition to what Tim said about why courts haven't been protecting economic liberty, whether those rationales hold up at the state level, and also whether there's an added cultural component. I always think about that law can't really move without culture, and in our culture, work has become sort of denigrated, a dirty thing. I mean, I don't want to date myself or something, but you know, I have much younger siblings, and work to them isn't what it was to me. And I wonder if that affects all of this.
It's kids seen as, these days.
It's true. Work is seen as exploitative or dirty or bad or what have you. And how does that contribute to this problem?
Well, I wish we could blame the lack of protection of the right to earn a living on Gen Z, but and I could just point at my daughter. But
it's the fault of the greatest generation.
You could say that too. But without delving into generational politics, I think it is all those things that you listed that that you quoted. It is.
That I quoted you on.
Well, it is unenumerated rights, but the fact that you have to go to unenumerated rights to protect economic liberty often. But as Tim says, that's not entirely true. There's lots of property in the Constitution. There's the Contrast Clause, right, which has its own huge problems in addition to those about rational basis and unenumerated rights. So it is a lot of things why courts don't protect economic liberty. The question I ask in this context, and I don't go into in the paper, but we could talk about here, is why is that? Why are some of those same problems in federal court true also in state court for a lot of the reasons that Tim was just talking about, when you have state constitutions adopted at different times than the federal constitution? A lot of them are quite recent in relatively in time, and yet not just the tests, but the methodology and all kinds of other ways of looking at the law and the relationship between the Constitution and whatever the barrier is to make a living is looked at the same way as it is in federal court. That really, I guess, is the $64,000 question, to date myself, of state constitutional law in this context. But I think there's another thing going on that I've been thinking about more recently, and I can't quite put my finger on, and it's always been true in American jurisprudence, but I think maybe it is more true now, and that's that American judges have never quite figured out how to be common law judges and also statutory constitutional judges. Maybe it's just something about the mind or the legal mind that has, you're always having cross-pollination between those two methodologies. So the common law system, right, most of you here know, you take precedent, you apply it to the case, you come up with a legal rule that then evolves into the next case, and it's okay if the law changes over time. That's just the common law method, right? Lots of people have written about this, considering where we are. Of course, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, Friedrich Hayek wrote all about this process, and we like this process to a great degree. Now, Hayek preferred the common law process in a lot of ways to statutes, to legislation, because it's more adaptable, it's actually more protective of liberty in the long run. Great. Well, Constitution is not the common law, right? Right now I'm doing a project where I'm reading through debates in state constitutional conventions where they put together state constitutions. And these people will spend hours arguing about whether this one word should be in this one spot of the Constitution, something that doesn't make sense if you're talking about the common law. There was this one debate I just read where it was one of these clauses at the beginning of state bills of rights that talks about the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness and all that. And it said, the draft said, free and independent. And they'd spent hours about whether to take out the word independent. Men are born free and independent because, well, they're not really born independent. I mean, everyone has to be raised by your parents. So why would you have the word independent in there? And then people passionately said, no, we need the word independent in there because it has to do with our liberty and blah, 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 blah. Okay, if you spent all that time and effort assembling a state constitutional convention, writing it up, getting it ratified by the people, and then 20 years later when the state Supreme Court is interpreting it, there's like, okay, well, the common law method, we look at the state down the road that has completely different language but had this methodology, and it's a 4-point test, and okay, we'll apply that here, and all that work is ignored. It's like it never happened. And so it's not the fault of the common law that it is why that's happening, but there's a disjunction in methodology there that I think the some of the solution to that is to, you know, remind ourselves that it's a constitution we're expounding in that circumstance. Originalism can be part of that, but it doesn't have to be. Textualism can be part of that. Just a reminder that we need to take all the effort that these people made when they put this constitution together seriously, and not just be doing policy making. And I can't quite put my finger on what's there. I certainly don't want to say we shouldn't have a common law system and we should go to a French or Californian code-based system. It's a mean dig at California, but you know what I mean. And so that doesn't, you know, infect, to use a loaded word, how we interpret constitutions. But I think there's something there about in taking constitutional text more seriously, including when it has to be the text that is protecting unenumerated rights.
Yeah, what you said just reminded me of one of my favorite lines from Tocqueville, when he says, "Although lawyers love liberty, they love order more. And as long as it is the legitimate authority that is taking away men's freedom, they are more or less content." Which is absolutely true. Lawyers tend to care more about all the technical details about whether or not all the votes were properly counted and the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted than whether or not we are protecting the liberty referred to in the Constitution that is promised to us. And it's, I think part of it is, there's a lot of reasons why. Some of it goes is philosophical. It's what philosophers call physics envy, which is that philosophers tend to want their work to be as precise as physics, and life just doesn't work that way. And so then that makes people feel uncomfortable. And a lot of the time, the lawyer's response to feeling that discomfort is to say, "Oh, well, we'll just leave it to the political process to decide because, you know, we're incapable of answering those questions." Well, of course, what that really translates into is we're not going to enforce the Constitution.
Or to just go full board legal realist.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Not physics, we'll just do
just
whatever
impose
we think
power.
Is best.
Yeah.
Both of you have mentioned a few state constitutional provisions, the Ninth Amendments being one of them. That's becoming a better known one, maybe as hot as constitutional law topics get. But I wonder if you might mention a favorite, more obscure state constitutional provision you two have come across in your research and litigation.
Obscure. Well, my favorite obscure one is in Hawaii, where the state constitution preserves the law of the splintered paddle. The law of the splintered paddle is a tradition where the story goes that during one of his wars of conquest, Kamehameha was mistaken by an ordinary man, Maka Ainana, as they say in Hawaii. Didn't realize that it was Kamehameha, and thought he was just an ordinary robber or something, and hit him upside the head with a canoe paddle. And that rather than put the man to death, as was his wont as an ali'i, Kamehameha instead said, no, let the elderly and the infirm lie by the roadside. And this has been interpreted as meaning that we shouldn't war against civilians during wartime. Or further, that we should provide some sort of basic welfare protection for people. And nobody quite knows what it means, but it was part of the original constitution of Hawaii when it was an independent country, and then it was incorporated into the state constitution. I don't believe it's ever actually been implemented or interpreted definitively by the state Supreme Court, but it's kind of fun and interesting. But it's also, more on a serious level, it's a great example of how state constitutions are adapted to local needs and circumstances in ways that the federal constitution not only is not, but was explicitly designed not to be, right? The federal constitution was designed to allow for local autonomy to a great degree, and state constitutions can be more tailor-made to address issues that are present in that state. So in California, as I mentioned earlier, there's a state constitutional right to access the beaches. We in Arizona do not have a state constitutional right to access the beaches, unsurprisingly. So state constitutions can be adapted in this way, and on an even deeper level than that is the question of how state culture affects a state constitution. I mentioned Alaska. The Alaska Supreme Court, in that case that I mentioned, which is called Ravin, State versus Ravin. In that case, they specifically consult the culture of the state. Our state, they say, was created by people who really highly valued privacy and independence. It's the last frontier. You don't go to Alaska if you want to live in a big city with a lot of social services conveniently located next to you. You go to Alaska to be a pioneer, and so we are a pioneer state, and we prize that sort of independence. And in the wake of the Supreme Court's overruling of Roe versus Wade, I think we're seeing this kind of discussion once again really reach the top of the agenda nationally, and questions about state culture, about state political and constitutional culture, are going to be central to that debate, because we all know we have red states and blue states, we have states that are more liberal and conservative, and we have and different dynamics as to what those terms even mean in one state versus another. And I think those are relevant considerations. So relevant, in fact, that I think even if a state constitution uses language that is word for word identical to the federal constitution, I think it's legitimate for a state court to interpret that language differently than the federal courts do, depending on the cultural and historical circumstances of that state, if they warrant doing so. This is a point of dispute that I had an argument with a former state Supreme Court judge about this in New York once, who insisted that it was ridiculous to assume that there's a difference between the political culture or the soul of New York as opposed to New Jersey. To which my response is, there is a huge difference between the political culture or constitutional soul, if you will, of Hawaii and New York State, or California and Arizona. You know, there is a big difference, and those differences are relevant in constitutional interpretation.
Well, I don't think you can get more obscure than the Hawaii law, but do you have a favorite?
Well, I'll try. So thinking of relevant difference, my adopted home state of Minnesota has a provision in it that, and I apologize to my Minnesota gardening friends who are watching, but it is a gardener's rights clause, and I can't remember the exact words, but it says you do not need a license to sell or peddle, or maybe it's grow or peddle, the proceeds of your own garden. So it has to, because of the wording, it has to be your residence. So it can't be like a farm, a mile away where you go and plow the field. It has to be your own residence, that land, and you grow products on that land, and you sell or peddle. So it doesn't have to be you selling them at that spot. You cannot be forced to get a license.
That's great. Talk about a true fruit of the labor's clause.
Well, although it gets worse. So it was pushed by someone, I can't remember the exact story, but it was in the early 1900s, someone was cited for and prosecuted for essentially peddling. And so it was not part of the original 1857 Constitution. It was then put on the ballot and adopted as an amendment. Now, when it was adopted, I think they thought that this was pretty important thing. Peddling was a big deal back then. A lot of the economic liberty cases from that period, not just Minnesota, but other parts of the country, have to do with peddling and vending. And so for some reason, it wasn't put in the state Bill of Rights. It's elsewhere in the Constitution. The whole Constitution was recodified and slimmed down a bit in the 1970s, but it was kept. But for some reason, it's in the miscellaneous article near the end of the Constitution. And the state Supreme Court at one point said that it is not treated as seriously because it's not in the Bill of Rights, which has nothing to do with the reason why they adopted this, right? And it says, you just can't get a license. But then that raises another question of like, okay, how broadly does it protect this right? And the court has really, unfortunately, not known what to do with it, despite its very broad language. There was a case a few years ago about the application of it to butchering. So someone who I think was selling beef, the cows he had on his property, and he wasn't abiding by certain can't exactly remember the laws. My knowledge of butchering isn't all that deep, but how the meat was processed, essentially. And there was a split on the court. There was a plurality that said that the provision can't be treated too broadly. There was another one that said, I think we applies here. There was a concurrence that kind of split the difference. And it has not come up again. Now, it has come up, and this is another example of strategic litigation. One time it did come up at the Minnesota Court of Appeals, thankfully this case did not go to the Minnesota Supreme Court, was someone trying to grow and sell marijuana in, I think, the 1990s, long before we had liberalization of marijuana laws. And he lost that case, as you might imagine, and they were not too sympathetic about it. It says, look, I have a right to grow and sell what I want. Yeah, but that doesn't mean you can grow anything, and so it doesn't give you a right to grow and sell marijuana. I think there is future for this. This is not a clause that no one knows about. If you talk to serious gardeners in Minnesota, this is the first thing they will bring up to you. We brought a case once in federal court on behalf of some farmers, and a fan of this clause who was a lawyer came to me and said, why aren't you raising a gardener's rights clause? And I said, it's not really relevant here, but I appreciate it. So they're passionate about their gardener's rights clause. People know about it. There have been some attempts to litigate it in recent years. It hasn't got to the Supreme Court, but I think it is kind of a tale of some hope, because it's something specific to the state constitution. A lot of people know about. They have tried to do something with you can only bring justices so far if they don't want to go there, but there have been some signs of hope, and I think the justices realize that, yes, this is part of the Constitution. It's there for a specific reason. We can't just ignore its text, even if we don't want to stick our necks out in trying to enforce it.
Before we turn to questions from the audience, we've discussed how state constitutional provisions are underexplored, and I agree with something you said earlier, which is that might be in part because just some very practical difficulties that state courts have sometimes, different rules depending on the locality, and not all lawyers are familiar. They take longer. Sometimes it takes longer to litigate in state court than federal court. Maybe professors don't explore it because there's not as much glory than in studying the federal constitution. But just because these provisions are underexplored doesn't mean that they're unexplored, and there are in fact pending cases and have been pending cases in state courts on state constitutional provisions in the economic liberty realm. So I wonder if you two want to talk about any cases that are pending at IJ or Goldwater.
Well, we have a case pending in with regard to the gift clause that I mentioned earlier in the Arizona Supreme Court and in the Texas Supreme Court also. Gift clauses are state constitutional provisions that prohibit subsidies from taxpayer money to private businesses. But not just private businesses, any private undertaking, any kind of private entity. And as I mentioned, Arizona has a particularly strong clause. Our clause was copied word for word from the Montana Constitution of 1889. Montana then got a new constitution in the 1970s and got rid of it, so we're the only ones left with it. And the clause prohibits the government from giving or lending any funding or providing any aid to a private entity, quote, by subsidy or otherwise, end quote. A broad catch-all language that was intended to prohibit not just direct cash payments from the Treasury to a private business, but also indirect subsidies. For example, there's actually a Texas case from the 1930s where the government said to a railroad, if you'll build this railroad, we will exempt you from all tort liability for 999 years. And the Texas Court of Appeals said that's an unconstitutional gift. It's giving them something of economic value as a way of subsidizing their business operations. So in Arizona right now, we have a situation where we have a statute called the Jeeplet Statute. This is a statute that says if you're a vendor, a private business, and you're doing business on land owned by the government, like, for instance, you're selling magazines at a newsstand in the government-owned airport, for example, well, government land is not taxed. It's not subject to property tax. So they pass this statute, the Jeeplet Statute, that says, so instead you have to pay this Jeeplet tax, they call it. And the idea was to put this, to impose a tax where otherwise it would not exist. Well, what the local governments have come up with is a clever scheme of manipulating this in order to give subsidies to private businesses. What they do is they say to the developer, okay, you want to build a high-rise luxury condominium complex? All right, give your land to us. Sell it to us for $1. Now it'll be government-owned land, and we'll lease it back to you at below market rates, and now you're subject to that GEEPLIT tax instead, which is way lower than the property tax. And local governments have the power to waive the GEEPLIT tax, so we'll do that. So now, tax-free, total tax-free, right? Millions of dollars of subsidies to this private developer. So we're challenging one of those schemes in the Arizona courts right now. And it turns out, when you look into the history, that the Arizona clause borrowed from Montana, one of the reasons Montana wrote such a broad clause was because they wanted to prohibit precisely these kinds of tax exemption subsidies to railroads, particularly. That was the big one in the 19th century. But any kind of private business. So tax exemption subsidies are a subsidy just like writing out a check. So we're doing one of those cases in the Arizona Court of Appeals right now. The Texas Supreme Court case is a case where the government is also subsidizing public sector labor unions, but through a process called release time, which is where the government, in the collective bargaining agreement with the police union or the fire union or whatever, says, okay, we will pay, in addition to all this other stuff, we will pay the salaries of, you know, one or two or three employees who don't actually work for the government at all. They work entirely for the union. So they do things like recruiting and going to political rallies and organizing pizza parties and meeting with congressmen and endorsing political candidates and giving them money and all this sort of thing. And they're doing it entirely on the taxpayer dime. Well, that's a gift, because the government is paying money and getting no services in return. It's going directly to this union as a way of subsidizing their operation. So that's the issue in our case pending in the Texas Supreme Court right now.
So we have a few brewing at the Institute for Justice across the country, and some are about to boil over, we hope, because they're near the end of the cycle. So, for example, just yesterday, my colleague Josh Windham argued at the North Carolina Supreme Court on a challenge we have to their certificate of need law, a protectionist licensing scheme that Anastasia needs doesn't need me to explain to her about how it works with the litigation she's done. So that is pending, and North Carolina is interesting because it actually has enumerated economic liberty protection, the fruit of one's own labor clause that's in the North Carolina Constitution. We had last year, if you're interested in this area, you should check out if you don't already know, the victory we had in Georgia, where economic liberty was said to be an unenumerated right under its due process clause, but it was a victory against the laws or the state's lactation consultant license, which the court unanimously found to be unconstitutional under a standard that is a higher standard than the federal rational basis test. And we also had an argument, I think it was earlier this week, my colleague Keith Neely argued at the Louisiana Intermediate Appellate Court, where Louisiana has a license for braiders. So this is a little bit like the other litigation we've done in the past about cosmetology laws requiring people who just simply braid hair to get a cosmetology license. Here they actually do have a braiding license, but it is far and beyond what one needs to actually earn a living, and it doesn't make sense for what the braiders need. It's 500 hours of instruction with nothing in the law about what you're actually supposed to learn, and so that will be pending in the Louisiana court system, and that may go higher after that. So keep a watch on all of those and other cases, and I think we're going to be hearing more and more examples of like the North Carolina case and the Georgia case in coming years.
Especially after everyone reads your articles.
I hope so.
So if anyone here in the audience has a question, feel free to raise your hand. We'll have one of our trusty legal associates come over. And while we prepare for that, I was just going to read a question that's come in from our online audience. Well, first we got somebody saying, hello, everyone, greetings from the Philippines. So that's exciting. Hello to our viewers in the Philippines. But secondly, we have a question here. Is the answer to this problem of courts not protecting economic liberty to give rational basis review more teeth, or is the answer to elevate the right to earn a living to fundamental status, as Judge Ho argued in his concurrence in Golden Glow?
Oh, I definitely think the latter. I think that the right to earn a living is a central part of what we mean by the American dream. It is one of the crucial rights that state constitution makers intended to protect, particularly in these fruits of their labor clause provisions. It's hard to imagine how that is not a fundamental right when it's listed in such terms and alongside other rights that are clearly fundamental. Not to mention that the arbitrary distinction between fundamental and non-fundamental is entirely policy driven. It's entirely based on the prejudices of the legal elite class, which, you know, they make their living with words. Therefore, free speech is a fundamental right. And, you know, if all the lawyers out there were also plumbers, plumbing would be considered a fundamental right. It's entirely arbitrary and politics driven. So yes, I would definitely endorse fundamental status, and I think that so-called rational basis with bite is a step in that direction. But we should not leave it at that. And more important, I really don't like this term rational basis with bite either, because there are not two types of rational basis test. The Supreme Court has addressed this specifically and refused to endorse the idea that there are two different rational basis tests. And I think those of us who believe in liberty should be very reluctant to encourage them to do so. Because if we do that, we are going to end up on the short end of the stick. Because the legal community is so dead set at present against protecting this fundamental right of economic freedom that if we subdivide rational basis, economic liberty is going to get dropped into the lower category. And I don't think that that's wise strategically as a litigation matter, and it's certainly not warranted by the Constitution, but of course, neither is the fundamental, non-fundamental distinction.
Yeah, I try not to use the fundamental, non-fundamental distinction. I think it's a garbage distinction about how rights are protected by state and federal constitutions. I'd be happy with a lot of kinds of scrutiny, as we call them, for the right to earn a living and other rights. Any kind of real judging, as Clark Neely likes to say, would be quite satisfactory. A lot of these barriers that are litigated in court that Goldwater and IJ litigate and just regular entrepreneurs have to deal with, something like, if you want to call it intermediate scrutiny, medium rare scrutiny, as my old professor Mike Paulson likes to say, whatever you want to call it, if your judge is looking at real facts and ends means fit and that kind of thing, that's going to take care of a lot of these problems, whether or not you ever get to the strict scrutiny level.
Strict scrutiny for all laws, that's what I say. All right, questions from the audience?
Yes. You both touched on the homogenization of state constitutional systems with the federal constitution. And my question is really simple. It's just, is time of the essence here to take advantage of the strategies that you outlined in your talk here and in your drafts?
Is time of the essence? Well, I suppose, justice delay is justice denied. So, of course, time is of the essence of every litigant. And that's no less true of an entrepreneur who wants to put food on the family to feed his family and can't because the government imposes some ludicrous licensing requirement, like in Louisiana, where you have to get a license to be a florist. You have to get a government permission slip to arrange flowers for money in the state of Louisiana, in the free state of Louisiana. It's repulsive. Or the con laws that say that you can't run a business, you can't run a moving company unless you get permission from all of the moving companies that are already operating in the state. And you know what? They're not likely to approve of their own competition. I mean, some of these laws are so insane, and that the only reason why they exist is because judges refuse to take these issues seriously, and that's because of the rational basis test. And the rational basis test is a purely politics-driven, policy-oriented act of judicial abdication that cannot be justified on the basis of state or federal constitutional history or text or philosophical principle.
To your question, I don't know if time is of the essence, that this is a moment in politically or jurisprudentially that's quite different than other moments in time and in pushing for the right to earn a living in state constitutions. I will say though that the whole textualist revolution, originalism being a big deal in the current generation of lawyers. To some extent, that is going to have the unintended or unforeseen consequence, and it is already, of a lot of these judges who, when they were lawyers or law students, said, you know, I believe Justice Scalia, and I think textualism is the way to go, and you should read the text and take it seriously. And now a lot of those people are getting to be judges in state courts, and they're reading things like, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. There's the text. What does that mean? Now, some of them already have kind of shied away from that. Well, I mean, you know, there's text and there's text. But a lot of them, I think, are going to be true to that, and in some cases already have, and are going to take state constitutions seriously in a way that the past U.S. Supreme Courts have not. I don't need to enumerate all the times that it happened, but you know the cases I'm talking about. And so because of that case law, and because of the federal government being what it is, the U.S. Supreme Court isn't maybe likely to move in that direction in some ways. But at the state level, there's all this freedom for these textualists to take this text seriously. And I think in that way, I'm quite hopeful for the coming years and to see what comes from that.
Although it just occurs to me, perhaps you mean by time of the essence because of the Dobbs decision and the nationwide controversy now over abortion rights. That definitely gives us, it's created a real opportunity to argue about state constitutions, what kind of rights they protect. And so far, I think it's very impressive how state courts have been dealing with this. The one that really comes to mind is the Kansas Supreme Court's decision in, I think it's called Hodes and Nauzer versus Stewart, I think is the name of the case, on whether abortion is protected under the Kansas Constitution. Now, what's impressive about that decision is they really take these natural rights issues seriously. I mean, they're really going into what John Locke said and what he meant, not just as a historical matter, but like, what does this really mean? And both sides, the majority and the dissent, are doing this. And no matter what your view is on abortion, that is an impressive display of legal reasoning. If you think the majority was right, or if you think the dissenting opinion is right, they're both, they show that judges are capable of doing this. They are capable of addressing this issue, and they may come out with disagreements, as judges, of course they do, because they're human beings, and then the people can decide whether to retain or throw judges off the bench, whether to amend the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. That's how our system is supposed to work, and I think so far, anyway, the reaction to the Dobbs decision at the state constitutional level has been very, very, I'm optimistic about it.
Indiana had a case last year that is similar vein.
I think Wisconsin, too, if I remember right. So there's been a number of these states that have been doing this.
Maybe to the questioner's point, there was another related question online about, you know, coming off of this pandemic, that I think the pandemic changed things for a lot of people. It brought home how important it was to be able to make your own working conditions, stay open, even when the government, all of us were really affected, I think, at an employment level in some sense about being shut down. We saw the businesses around us fall. And there was a lot of litigation during the pandemic that I think fared better in terms of economic liberty than usual. And I wonder if there's a special moment presented by that situation as well for economic
liberty. And the Trump presidency and the Biden presidency, because whichever side you're rooting for there, it's a testament to the importance of federalism, that the federalist system is designed to be, in some ways, very flexible, to be able to protect us against sudden changes at the federal level. But on the other hand, every generation has their crisis. I mean, when I was in law school, it was Bush versus Gore in September 11th happened when I was in con law. You know, so that was a heady time to be in constitutional law class. You know, so every generation has its crisis, and so these opportunities are always there for the taking. I hope we take them.
Yeah, I think some people were, you know, some libertarians were disappointed by some of the litigation during the pandemic because courts were, you know, upholding everything and these restrictions are crazy or whatever. But actually, there were some examples of some of these laws being found to be just arbitrary and irrational, even during the pandemic, where you can understand, right? We all remember why judges would be hesitant there. And since then, with those kinds of restrictions having happened, you literally, right, you can't leave your house for certain reasons. Now, in comparison, a lot of these restrictions look kind of, you know, they don't look as scary as they, or needed as they used to be, especially when we learned that a lot of this, of course, was overreaction, what happened during the pandemic. So in the future, I think that contrast can help give judges some perspective about, wow, I can find this law to be unconstitutional and we're all going to go about our business and things are going to be okay.
I think we have one last question from the audience and then we'll break.
Just to start out, thanks to both of you for a really good talk and for your excellent work in this area. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on why economic liberty is sometimes viewed as a conservative issue or a libertarian issue, and are there things that we can do as litigators to try to frame this in a way that is maybe more appealing across the political spectrum? I do a lot of litigation in Wisconsin. We just swung from being a conservative Supreme Court to now being a liberal Supreme Court, and I worry that if I were to bring certain cases to that court, they may not view it favorably. They might see it as kind of like a conservative pipe dream, but it's never been clear to me why that is.
Why don't you go first on
this? You can close this out then. I think there's two answers. For legal elites, as we like to say, a lot of this unfortunately really does come down to the ghost of Lochner. And so a lot of more progressive academics and judges will think about what they learned in law school and that there was this Lochner time and then there wasn't because of FDR in the court, and we can't go back to there because of all the people dying in the streets or whatever used to happen back then. And we saw this even in the dissent in Dobbs, where you can agree with the dissent excoriating the Dobbs majority for all different reasons, and then they have this page about, but we couldn't also protect economic liberty because, you know, those were bad times back then, and we realized that was an error. Doesn't that contradict what you were just, you know, talking about? So part of that is educating those people in power that is not something you need to worry about. Now, how do you fix that? Well, I think part of it is, and this is a process of accretion, but we bring cases that have compelling stories that aren't about major corporations trying to get rid of health and safety laws. They're about entrepreneurs who can't compete against their big competitors because of how their competitors have used the political process. And we've all know these cases and heard about them. So the more we bring those stories, the more we convince people who are affected by the ghost of Lochner that, you know, Lochner was over 100 years ago, who cares? I want to protect these people from the state not allowing them to earn a living, and this is a way to do it, and things are going to be okay after that happens. And the more these cases happen, like the one I talked about my colleagues had in Georgia last year, the more we're going to be able to do that.
The reason why economic liberty is seen as a conservative issue is entirely an artifact of the leftist mythology that capitalism is somehow conservative, when in reality, capitalism is an enormously dynamic force that actually is hugely liberating, particularly to the people who lack the political influence necessary to gain government favors. They're the ones who need economic freedom, constitutional protections for economic freedom the most, because they don't have the wherewithal to lobby the government for favoritism in the way that entrenched monopolistic entities do. And I think that story is becoming clear to a lot of people, thanks to the work of the last 25 years, led, of course, by the Institute for Justice, and then by Pacific Legal Foundation and at the Goldwater Institute where I work. What we've done is we've, in case after case, demonstrated why it's the entrepreneur, it's the little guy who needs this constitutional protection for economic liberty the most. And the reason why these cases are so compelling, hair braiders or lactation consultants or gardeners or whatever it might be, is because that helps to dramatize to people that these are not abstract issues about how the economy operates. These are fundamental issues of how freedom works for real people in real cases. And if you present those kinds of cases, it makes it harder for the judges to blind themselves with ideological preconceptions.
Well, Tim took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say something to the same effect, that economic opportunity, I think, is seen as something for only the Jeff Bezoses of the world, when in reality it's for everyone. It's the great equalizer in terms of opportunity. It allows the people born into poverty to lift themselves out, and it's something that, you know, I'm all about. Jeff Bezos should be a billionaire. He's done amazing things, but it's also economic opportunities for everyone. It's something we need to emphasize in our messaging. But with that, our time is running out. We're going to take a brief break for coffee, and we'll resume with another panel.
Thank you.